Some choices that we make, personal choices that we make, they turn out as we hoped. We try to balance up things, we take a decision, we go through it, and it ends up where we want it. But others don't. Others don't. We try to make the right decision, we think we're doing the right thing, but where we end up is not where we expected. And we start to have regrets. We can get very upset, we can berate ourselves. Why did I? And we look at ourselves. Or we look at others and moan about others. Why did they? Or we can blame God. Why did he? But as Christians, we try, and it's hard, but we try to react differently. We believe that we are the Lord's disciples. One way of picturing that is simply to say we walk through life with him, following him. He's ahead of us, we're travelling through life with him. He's in control of it, he's guiding it. He's bringing the situations. And so as Christians, we try instead to bring a question to our minds and hearts. When we reach some of these situations where it seems our choices have not ended up where we hoped, we ask ourselves the question, so what then would the Lord have me learn? He's brought me here. Didn't go where I thought I was going to go. What would he have me learn? Maybe to see my sin and repent. Maybe that's why he brought me to this moment. Maybe to see sin in somebody else and help them. Maybe that's why he's brought me to this moment. Or maybe the lesson is completely different. Maybe it's not connected to sin. Maybe it's something else he's teaching me. But what would he have me learn? And then we go back to Jesus' teaching in Scripture, the very words he said to his disciples, but then, of course, expanded out right across the Bible, New Testament and Old Testament, believing that he inspired it all, to understand our lives in a better way, as far as we can, to learn the lessons that he wants us to learn. It's what we try to do as believers, though it's hard. Our verses are a striking example of that. Let me explain then how we're going to tackle them, and then hopefully we'll see a little bit of that. Mark 14 is where Jesus' great act begins. The thing that maybe we would say above everything else he's remembered for. Up until now he's talked about it. Up until now he's been talking of his death. His death upon the cross. Ever since the middle of Mark, when his disciples said to him, "You're the Messiah, we believe that now," he started to say to them, "So I'm going to die." That's what Messiah has to do. So he's been talking about it. It's key to him being the Messiah who saves. He's been preparing his disciples for his death. Mark 13, we saw him do more than that. He's been preparing his disciples for his resurrection. He's been preparing his disciples for his ascension. He said, "You will see the Son of Man come with the clouds of glory." That's what lies on the other side of this death. It's going to unlock a whole new era of history, he said in Mark 13. Everything's going to shift. Everything's going to change after the cross. He's been preparing them. He's been preparing them for how life for them, life for Israel, life for the world, never be the same again. Everything changes when he dies and rises. But that was talk. Now it's action. The waiting is over and the most terrifying act of Jesus' life must take place. Evil's going to break onto him. It's worth us, isn't it, just for a moment even, trying to remember that there is a man at the heart of this story. He's our king. He's the Son of God. But he's truly a man. By the time you get to Gethsemane, you see what the stress is doing to him. But the stress is here. You know, we can view him sort of in this room, just, well, he's the beneficial Lord, just looking across everything, interesting comments to make, thoughtful words, dealing with those troublesome disciples, dealing with people coming to him. Remember, the man at the heart of this story is going through the most enormous stress, because now he knows death's right at the door. It's really close now, and it's going to be horrible. So understand something of his reaction, including in this story, in the light of what he's now under. But the evil which will break on him will be for good purpose, and it will even begin here. So verses 1 to 11. In a way, you could describe these verses as almost like an evil sandwich with a good filling. The evil is on either side of it, first and last verses. The good bit is in the middle. So that's why you will tackle it. I'll talk about the evil first at start and end, the good in the middle, and then go back to learning for life. Firstly, the evil. Verses 1 and 2 and verses 10 and 11. It begins like this. Now the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were only 2 days away, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law were looking for some sly way to arrest Jesus and kill him. That's the start. At the end, we go back to that group and we see them dealing with Judas and making plans. The leaders want to kill Jesus, but they're not sure how. By the end of these verses, Judas will provide the way. But Mark does recount the story with something set in the middle of it. We've seen him do that before, actually. We've seen him sandwich something into the heart of a story to help us think rightly about it. And that's why we'll look at the filling in part two, the good filling. But first, the evil. Verse 1 tells us it's the time of the Passover. So that's the festival that remembers the loss of the firstborn of Egypt, the killing of the lambs to protect the firstborn of Israel when the Israelites were saved out of that country. The Passover itself is a day, but it ran into a seven-day festival. The seven-day festival was known as the Festival of Unleavened Bread. That probably means that verse 1 were at the start of April, probably the year AD 30, and given what Mark tells us, it's probably a Wednesday evening. On this Wednesday evening, says Mark, bad stuff is going on at the temple. The chief priests and the lawyers, the experts in law, are meeting in secret and they're discussing. They're discussing how to get Jesus arrested and get him executed. Jesus said, not that long earlier, there are a bunch of crooks up there. It's like a safe house for gangsters. Turns out, they are. They're political crooks. They don't get what they want simply by mob technique, you know. They don't sort of nab Jesus down a back street, put concrete shoes on him and drop him in the Jordan. They don't just kidnap him. It's got to be legal for them. I presume that's because they want Jesus put to public shame. They don't just want him to vanish, because as they say, if he vanishes, that will cause trouble. They need him to put to public shame, exposed as an enemy of the state, exposed as a troublemaker for the Romans, with all the weight of the state turning on him. And that way they hope to kill the movement that's behind him, those who follow him. Remember, it's Passover. At Passover, Israel gathers in Jerusalem. So in the city, you've got a lot of people, a lot more than usual. And that includes a lot of Galileans, a lot of northerners, a lot of the people from Jesus' home area. Now, Passover could be a tinderbox at the best of times. If people are going to get upset about stuff, if people are going to start moaning about tyrants, well, Passover is a jolly good time to do it. So Jerusalem is packed full of people. Jerusalem is a tinderbox of trouble. Jerusalem's got a lot of northerners who come from Jesus' home area in it. And that's why they say, so if we're going to do this, we really have got to do it carefully. We can't just grab him. His murder could erupt into a massive riot. So they decide to wait. They're going to wait till after the festival. And then something happens. There's a knock at the door. This is imaginary now. And a man walks into their office. And it's one of his team. One of the 12. one of his friends. He knows all Jesus' movements. And he says, I've come to help. I'll tell you when you can get him. And they can't believe their luck. I mean, they just say, great, well, fine, we'll pay you then. Tell us what you want. You can have what you like. They were delighted to hear this, it says in verse 12, and promised to give him money. And so he watched for an opportunity to hand him over. It's a very ugly scene, isn't it? It's a horrible scene. Forces of evil tightening round Jesus' throat. So different from the start of Mark. You know, if you went back to Mark 1 now and reread it and thought about back then, you know, you go back to where Jesus had just called his first four disciples, given them that strong job title, you're going to be fishers of men now. And then he goes to a synagogue. What does he do there? He commands evil. He says, get out! Talking to a spirit. Then he goes to the home, interestingly enough, the home of another man called Simon. And there he heals a sickly mother-in-law. And then many demonized people turn up at the door and Jesus silences all those demons as well. Commands evil to be gone. It's another sandwich story, actually. You get evil either side and something good happening in the middle. But back in chapter 1, evil bows to Jesus. But now we've flipped around to the opposite because he's humbling himself. He's accepting the path given to him. The leaders who resent Jesus scheme to ruin him. The man who followed him, who said he loved him, is betraying him. By the way, what's Judas's motive? Elsewhere, we're told about Judas that he was a greedy thief. So there seems to have been that within the man. We're not told that here. Maybe Mark would just leave us in the context of something we were told earlier, that there was just a general sense of letdown within the team about Jesus, that they hoped he was going to deliver benefits to them, and the benefits haven't come yet. Now, the whole team are struggling with that. Maybe the point is Judas just really can't be dealing with it. He just has turned to hatred, or at least simply to personal benefit. Human beings, we do such great evil, don't we, with such tiny motives. You know, you think of these leaders with their envy and their bitterness, and they're going to turn all the mechanisms of the state on this man who's gone around healing people and doing good. Great evil out of such tiny motives. You think of Judas winding himself up, sitting up late at night. Everyone else has gone to bed, but he's still sat there with the lamp flickering. And he's got no phone to look through because they haven't invented them yet. So he's just indulging all his bitterness. And he reaches the point where he thinks, oh, tomorrow I've had enough of this. I'm going up to the temple. I'm sick of this now. And from a tiny thing, great evil is done. And it happens again and again in our lives, human beings' lives, that from tiny seeds and tiny motives, a motive of covetousness, a motive of lust, great evil follows. When we indulge sin, it can lead us where we don't expect. It can lead us where we don't intend. I mean, you do wonder, don't you? And we don't have the picture of it. What was the psychological steps that went through Judas's mind? How did he get to the point where he knocked on that door? But each one was probably a little step, but the little steps grew. And it is horrible, that betrayal. But then betrayal is the heart of sin in the end, isn't it? Because Adam betrayed God. He went behind God's back to satisfy his selfish desire. And that's been human patterns ever since. You know, all of us are made in God's image, but we've run away to satisfy ourselves. You know, Jesus' story of the prodigal son. We put ourselves first, we betray God. And sadly then, we betray others. Because that becomes the pattern of the heart. We betray others in marriage, or in family, or in work, or in friendship, like here with Judas. When we read the story of the evil that's done here, it should speak to us. It should say, Christians, be very wary of being unfaithful to others, to people you said you would stand with. It grows up so easily from small seeds, from small beginnings. Don't just let it grow until you're turning on somebody, as Judas does here. It's wicked, but it's a real temptation. Maybe we should add, you know, sometimes others will say to us, "You've betrayed me," and actually we haven't. Sadly, sin bends and twists everything. Sometimes, some of you may experience this, people will say to you, "You've turned against me. Why are you doing that?" And actually you haven't. They may do it to manipulate you. You know, it's nothing like a bit of emotional manipulation is there. "You're doing this to me." Sometimes they do it to control us through guilt. We have to be wary of those times. It's not those things I'm talking about. That's something different. We have to be wary of the lies of others. Sometimes people will say to us, "You betrayed me," just because we've reported some wrong way they've behaved to them or to somebody else, and they wanted to keep it secret, and they say, "That's betrayal." Well, it's not betrayal. We're not obliged to hide the sinful behaviour which should be admitted for the sake of justice. Just because someone says we betrayed them doesn't mean we did betray them. But again, we still have to come back to that thought we started with. The sin of betrayal, the sin of unfaithfulness, is one that easily takes the human heart. And we can fool ourselves and go along the road until we're doing things we never thought we would do. And we turn from the faithfulness to indulge ourselves. And if we've done that, then we deserve to be condemned. Watch out. The road begins with small sins, as maybe it did for Judas. That's the evil. Now the good, sandwiched in the middle. Verses 3 to 9. While he was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of a man known as Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. The nice thing with the story is that for all the evil going on, evil does not have the upper hand. Still, God's plan is working right through the middle of it all. And that's the lovely thing about it. Those who scheme secretly and telling tales are not in control. Jesus' path has been laid out by his Father. He knows where he's heading. He's willing to follow it through to the end. And he sees his Father making all kinds of preparations for it. He sees God's hand in the midst of the darkness. In verse 3, he's in the village of Bethany. Bethany is up on the Mount of Olives. If you remember, you've got Jerusalem, and then you've got the Mount of Olives alongside with a valley in between, the Kidron Valley. And Jesus has been going into Jerusalem, up to the temple, causing havoc, coming back out of the city, going back up onto the Mount of Olives. And he's staying in Bethany, this village. It seems to be the base where he makes his travels from. On this particular evening, he's dining at a friend's house. Again, it's the house of somebody called Simon. This time, it's Simon the leper. Simon, Simeon, fairly common name in the New Testament. You meet quite a few of them, so they often have to have something extra added to their name to distinguish them. Which one do I mean? So this one's known as Simon the leper. Maybe that's because he was healed of leprosy by Jesus. I don't think it's because he's currently got leprosy, because I don't think they'd be round at the house. Maybe he was once healed of it by Jesus, or maybe just for some other reason he's got that sort of name attached to him. Some people think this could be the father of Lazarus, for your interest. Now, that's not at all in Mark's Gospel. That's only in John's Gospel. But because Jesus, these events match an event in John 12, some people say, oh, it looks like Simon the leper could have been the father of Lazarus, the father of Mary, the father of Martha. And in fact, that might just mean he's actually not alive anymore. It's known as his house, but he doesn't actually live there anymore. He's deceased. Well, you can go away and think about that if you want to. Mark doesn't make anything of that. He doesn't tell us the names of any other family members. Jesus is in Simon's home. And something good happens there. But this time, it won't be like Mark 1 I mentioned earlier, Jesus doing good to somebody, but actually somebody doing good to him. It won't be Jesus coming to a woman who sadly is laying down and needs his help. It will be a woman coming to Jesus who is laying down, and she gives him help. Why is he laying down at all? Well, because he's reclining at a table. Folk would lay down to eat with their heads towards the food. If we had tried to do that with yesterday evening's Christmas meal, our kitchen wouldn't have held us all, so we all had to sit upright and pack round things on stools and stuff. But they're able to do in this house, so you lay towards the table, your head towards the food. The woman enters, she has a jar, she breaks it, and it releases a perfume. Why does she break it? I seem to find different answers to this. It can be because the jar was sealed to secure it, and that was just the way they secured it, rather than with a stopper or something. Or it may just be she's being extravagant in her action. I'm going to give all of this to Jesus with no reserve. I'm going to get the whole lot out of this jar. I'm just going to break it open and release everything. Whatever the reason, suddenly the smell of this very expensive perfume, which you can experience afterwards if you wish to, fills the house. The woman has spent much money. It's costly, this. In fact, she might even, some suggest, have given away a family heirloom, something that had been handed on for some special occasion one day, or even something that might have been her pension, something which she would have kept as a way of ultimately selling in order to provide for herself. The way that people might provide for themselves is not always necessarily to store up lots of actual money, gold coins or whatever, but to have something that you can sell when the need arises. There's a possibility that that's what Jesus was giving to the people at the wedding at the start of John's Gospel. You know, he gives them this abundant wine, way too much for people to drink, and they've already had lots to drink anyway. And it may be that he was like giving a gift that they could subsequently sell. Certainly here, it might be the case of this woman. Whatever it is, though, she gives expensively. She gives something that costs her a lot. Reminds us of the poor widow back in chapter 12 who gave much at the temple out of love for the Lord, even though the gift, relatively speaking, was small. But she comes and she pours it over Jesus. It becomes like a sacrificial incense, the perfume of death. But not in the temple across the hill, but in a leper's home. Because God is now found where Jesus is. The temple is desperately trying to keep everybody clean so we can offer incense. Don't come in if you're a leper. But the real incense is being offered in a leper's home, because Jesus makes holy wherever he is. What's the motive of the woman? Well, if it's Mary in John 12, then maybe it's due to Jesus and Lazarus and his raising of her brother, etc. Maybe it's just love for that, or maybe it's more theological than that, because if it is Mary learned at Jesus' feet, and she might think, this is the son of David, this is the Messiah. No one's recognising that. I will anoint him, because he is anointed with God's Spirit. Maybe it's something of that. Or maybe she just feels for Jesus. You know, he runs his team with so little. And sometimes when people do live very careful lives, where they've little money and they just pay their way, sometimes somebody with more wants to just come in and say, look, just for once, just enjoy something really good, will you? Just let me lift your spirits. Maybe it's as simple as that. Whatever the reason, there's a sharp contrast with the temple, isn't there, in the evil section. Over there, it's all greed and envy. That's the nature of the temple on the hill opposite. This temple, house of a leper, there's love and there's care. And there's thoughtfulness and there's generosity. The two places are striking. But sadly, as is Jesus' common experience, other people in the room can't see it. So verse 4, some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages, and the money given to the poor. At Passover, you would give to the poor. It was part of the festival. So it's very suitable they should say that. But Jesus simply shuts them down. Leave her alone. She's done good. Sure, the Old Testament says, do good to the poor, because they'll always be with you. Jesus is effectively quoting Deuteronomy 15. Deuteronomy 15 says, there will always be poor people in the land. Therefore I command you to be open-handed towards your brothers and towards the poor and the needy in your land. But he says, but nonetheless, the woman is right. The poor you will always have with you, but you and you can help them any time you want, but you will not always have me. He's pulling them back again to what he's been saying to them. He's about to become the poorest of the poor. He's going to die crucified like a common criminal, like a slave, the despised death. He's going to die naked with them gambling for his remaining possessions at his feet. Verse 8, I told you I was going to die. She's perfuming my body for burial. That's what her act is. Again, I want you to think of Jesus. Try to put yourself, as it were, in a small way into his mind. This is how real his death is to him. This is how much it's on his mind. This is the level of stress and pressure he's carrying. For him, this simple act is like she's getting him ready to be buried. Everybody else in the room is thinking about other stuff. Thinking about, oh, all that money and what we could have done and what the influence we could have had. And I wonder what we'll do tomorrow, and I wonder what I'll do later, and where is Judas right now? Jesus is thinking about death. For him, he's virtually laying in his coffin in the room. That's how heavy the pressure is on him. I mean, we sometimes feel the experience, don't we, of you're in a group maybe, and people are talking, and you hear one person make a comment, something's going on in their life. And you suddenly realise that while you're all bantering and joking and laughing about something, that person is carrying this huge burden. Maybe they just had a cancer diagnosis or something. And you realise that's all that's filling up their mind. And you even saw maybe that they just didn't look right and they didn't function right and they didn't seem to comment and they just looked sad. And you just sort of carried on with the bantering in the room. And then suddenly they make one comment and you realise that somebody in that room is carrying this huge weight. She's preparing me for death, says Jesus. The disciples have abjectly failed to prepare Jesus for death. They just wish he'd stop saying it. But this woman, even if not on purpose, has done so. She may have thought her act was just honour and kindness. The disciples may have thought her act wasteful and stupid. But Jesus, he feels completely differently about it. He sees in the woman and he sees in his father who is working through the woman an act of great beauty. He just suddenly says to them, I don't know what they were talking about moments earlier, but this event happens, they all start griping and he says, don't you see? This is beautiful. She's making me ready for death. Let's come to the final bit and finish up. Learning for life, learning from life. Verse 9, Jesus says, I tell you the truth, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her. Jesus says that what the woman has done is now part of the gospel that's going to announce God's kingdom, God's king to the world. She's ever going to be remembered. I want to see 4 points from that. Number one, thinking about this story, thinking about what we learn. Lesson number one. As small sin can grow into great evil, thought about that a moment ago, so small good. I should hold this up, shouldn't I? So small good can grow into great beauty. Now you find that idea right through Jesus' ministry. Kingdom starts with a mustard seed, talked about that just now, grew into a great tree. I seriously doubt that woman sort of expected her small act of love to become a message that will be preached for the next 2,000 years. I doubt she sort of, when she was coming in and sort of nervously thinking, oh, how can I break this without hurting anyone? Oh, there we go. Off we go. I doubt she was thinking, wow, I hope one day they'll be talking about this in Albion. We do something small and good in life, and it goes where we never expect. You know, when Judgment Day dawns, you will probably be surprised to find that what God rewards most were the very things you soon forgot about. I mean, Jesus actually tells stories like that, doesn't he? People will say to him, but Lord, Lord, when did we see you such and such? The things that will surprise you, that God will reward most, are the things that you forgot, that seem so unimportant. A moment's help, an afternoon's help to a brother, to a sister. So do small good things. It'd be great to do the great big things, wouldn't it? You know, set up some charity or something, or whatever it is. Do the small good things. They may actually have the biggest effect, way beyond what you can imagine. Secondly, remember in that sacrifice is key to everything. Often it isn't actually what you do at all. It's what you give up to do it. God does not need our abilities and resources to achieve his goals, but he loves to work with us. So what's he looking for? He's looking for our attitude in it. He doesn't need you. Goodness, he could send gallons of perfume into that room out of the clouds if he wanted to. But he loved the fact that woman gave up everything so that the room could be perfumed, so that Jesus could be anointed. It's the attitude. Sacrificial attitude is key to Christian living. Do we trust him? Are we willing to give up our dreams, desires, to serve God and others, believing that he will bring blessing in the end? Love your neighbour as yourself, says the command. Prioritise them as though they're you. Love your neighbour. Love your enemy, says Jesus. You've nothing to lose. Forgive greatly, says Jesus. Give generously, says Jesus. Look at me, he says. I gave up heaven. The glory of heaven for you. I don't know that this woman gave up her pension, but she may have done. Sacrifice is key to everything. Check your attitude. Third lesson from this. What do we learn? What would Jesus have us learn out of this situation? Thinking about learning from life situations. Notice how too easily we can misread the circumstances around us while thinking we're right. I mean, that's there in the heart of the story, isn't it? That moment, as I described it, Jesus himself carrying all this weight of his death, all the stress of what's coming. The woman comes in and Jesus sees it as a beautiful act, a generous gift from the Father, and everybody else in the room is getting it wrong. And yet, I imagine they were probably pretty confident that they knew how to think about this. They had learnt the lesson. I mean, they knew Jesus always pushes wealth away. They saw him with the rich young ruler. Don't you come to me with your money. Go and give it to the poor. Then come back and follow me. They knew Jesus' attitude to money. They knew how he dealt with wealth. And they'd seen him just give and give and give to needy people. He would pour himself out for needy people. And they knew that God's law said, open-handed to the poor. And Jesus always obeyed God's law rigorously. So they knew Jesus' attitude to the perfume. They had him sussed. Oops. They completely misread him. Because they weren't thinking about him or what he was passing through or what he'd said to them. They had a limited understanding. They're like Job's mates. They had this little understanding of life and they applied it to everything. You know, when you've got a big hammer, everything looked like a nail. If they'd listened to him talk repeatedly about his death and they'd taken to heart that he was going to die, they'd have loved this woman for what she did. So let's learn to be careful. Let's be very wary of thinking we see everything clearly. You know, we can be in that moment, can't we, where he says, but the Bible says, well, just make sure, eh? The Bible said, be open-handed to the poor. They were just applying Deuteronomy. But they got it wrong. Make sure you're careful. Make sure you're right. Take time to make sure. And then last of all, to wrap it up, back to where we started. We walk through life with Christ. We are his disciples. We follow him. He leads the way. He teaches us how to think about it, how to deal with it, how to make our choices. He's our Lord. He's our Saviour. He's our Rabbi. He's our King. He's our Shepherd, our Good Shepherd. So let's stop ourselves and try to make sure we think about things in terms of what he would teach us. Let's tackle our selfishness. Let's not always process life in terms of us. Let's remember that you and I are not the centre of the universe. Easy to say, pretty hard not to live by. I mean, there is a problem, obviously, in the room here, because I am the centre of the universe, so you lot obviously can't be. So, you know, it's fairly simply sorted out. You and I are not the centre of the universe. The Lord is working his plans. He doesn't feel obliged to explain it all to us, what he's up to. So when our choices don't turn out as we hoped, when our decisions don't end up where we wanted, pause. Before you spin into regret, oh, look at me, look what I've done. Or before you spin into accusation, look at them, look what they've done. Or before you look up in anger and say, look at God, look what he's done. Pause. And say to yourself, well, the outcome wasn't what I wanted. But what do I think he was doing in this? Where do I seek? Did I do this to seek his honour? Did I try to obey him? Well, I think I did try to do both of those things, so let me calm down for a moment. What would he now have me see from this then? What would he have me learn? Now, it might be he wants me to learn about my mistakes, fair dues. It might be he wants me to learn about my sins, fair dues. But sometimes the answer isn't any of that. It's somewhere else. These people totally got it wrong in understanding this woman's actions. And we do it to ourselves. So let's pause and think, oh, hang on, what is he teaching me? And let's make that our pattern, because we are disciples of Jesus Christ. We walk through life following him. He is the one who guides and teaches us. So let's live that way.